Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. I'm waking up. I'm barely awake. I'm in Providence, Rhode Island. Yeah, Providence. Where are you? What's going on? Where are you waking up? At home? I'm out here, man. I'm out in it. I'm looking at the gray day, the wet gray day out of the window here in Providence, Rhode Island. It brings me back, people. So, look, I am obviously not home. I am recording this on Sunday, so I don't know what happened last night at the Oscars. And for some reason this year, it feels more important than other years. To me, I wish I was watching it, but I'm going to be doing a show in Tarrytown, which is pretty exciting. These shows have been great. Honestly, just great. I talked to many of the Oscar nominees, and I think it's a good bunch of movies. I'm excited that Kimmel is hosting. It should be funny. I'll have to watch it after the fact. I guess I could maybe I could do a live simulcast, and we could all watch it in Tarrytown on my phone during my set. I'll just check in with it occasionally. I don't know if that's what I'm going to do. I do think a couple of the people I talked to might win. It's funny. I'm up here. Oh, by the way, Thurston Moore is on the show today. Now, this is one of those ones where it's pretty specific. He's a founding member of Sonic Youth. Rolling Stone ranked him as one of the greatest guitarists of all time. And he just he released his memoir last year, Sonic Life. Now, I've interviewed him many years ago before when I had a radio show in L.A. I was not happy. It was late at night. I didn't know enough about Sonic Youth. I thought it was uncomfortable. Talking to him, I felt like he thought I was an idiot. So that's what I was bringing to the table today, or when I did this. I had to make sure I was up to speed. You know, I like Sonic Youth enough. There's a lot of records, man. And I like that world of music enough, but I don't know much about it. I interviewed Kim Gordon a couple years ago, and I read her book and talked to her about New York in that era and about Sonic Youth and about music in general. But also with Thurston, I had to kind of really engage with the arc of that sound and what they invented and how they changed music. But his book is kind of great because, you know, for at least the first 100 or so pages, it's really just his experience coming into New York City at that time in the 70s. The later 70s, mid to late 70s as a teenager, and what was going on in music in New York was just, spiraling down. It was broke. It was kind of gnarly. And that's where all that sort of music of the 70s happened in terms of the beginning of punk, the Ramones and New York Dolls and the Heartbreakers and Verlaine and Patti Smith. And then it moved into, what he became part of, which was no wave music. And this is sort of a blind spot for me historically. You know things, you kind of hear things, you put things together in your own mind about this stuff. But that book is very clear and very personal about what New York felt like at that time, which is a very specific time. And what happened in those few years was kind of incredible musically, but he really kind of makes all the connections with all the people of that time. And it, for me, it was great. And also, I'm glad I read it before I talked to him because I could be more specific. But this time with Thurston, we had kind of a great conversation. It was pretty fun. And he was in good spirits. You know, he had some health issues. He's through them. And it's a unique, rare conversation with a guy that was very important in rock and roll history, the sounds, man. So my tour continues later in March. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia at the Buckhead Theater on Friday the 22nd, Boise, Idaho at the Egyptian Theater, Saturday, March 23rd at Comedy Fort. It's part of the Treefort Music Fest. Madison, Wisconsin, Barrymore Theater, Wednesday, April 3rd, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th. I'm at the Vic in Chicago, Friday, April 5th. Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater, Saturday, April 6th. Austin, Texas at the Paramount. That's Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center. Glenside, Pennsylvania. It's the Philly area, Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick. And Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. I will also be announcing new tour dates and locations tomorrow, so check my social media pages for pre-sale announcements. Oh, my God. So let's go through it. The show in Portland was great. I did, like, it's, you know, it's fun. The first show where you're stretching it out, did some high-quality riffing. The weather was heavy. It was a little chilly, and it was great. Great show. And then me and Claire O'Kane, the woman who's featuring for me, who's a very funny, odd, filthy, smart comic. What a relief. I didn't know her. I met her at a record store in L.A. She was a friend of Sharpling. She said she did stand-up. I'm like, all right. And then I needed an opener, and so now we're doing it. We're driving around for hours in a rental car, spending a lot of time together, but she's very smart, very funny, creative person. So it's been pleasant and good. Learning new things, listening to new music. You know how it goes. But the show in Portland was great. We drove down to Medford, down to Boston. And right when we got there, my buddy Ed Thill, he's got a bagel place, Goldilocks Bagels, right in Medford, where we were doing the show. We got there at 12:30. He was closed, but he's been working on making these kind of Sicilian-style pizzas. So he said, just come by a shop and knock on the back door. We'll have some pizza. So we drive into Medford. We're at the bagel place, walking in the back, eating pizza, maybe vegan pizza. He's a guitar guy showing me an SG. This is all happening. This is life. This is how it goes. You get pizza like it's a drug deal. Hung out there for a bit, then went back into Cambridge, checked into the hotel, went out to the Boston Commons, walked around, beautiful day, nostalgic. This is the road. This is the life. This is it's actually fucking amazing. The life is fucking amazing because I am engaged in the world. Thank God. Had a nice time. Did the show at Medford. 1,600 seats. Sold out. Excellent. Chevalier Theater was awesome. Was awesome. Great show. One for the ages. Thank God. Next day, I left my charger at the theater. I think part of my life is to redistribute chargers at venues across the country and hotel rooms. Why not just leave a charger for the next guy? That was a good charger, though. But I woke up, looked up an Apple store, and there was one 300 feet away from me. How often does that happen? Where you just, you know, like, I got to get this fucking thing. I don't know where I'm going to have. Oh, God damn. What? I'm in the Apple store? That's where I'm sleeping? Worked out. And the whole day sort of unfolded pretty well. Drove down here to Providence. There's a place called Plant City, which is like a vegan food hall in Providence. Insane. Insane. Had a vegan Reuben. Not quite enough fake corned beef on it, but it was good. These massive onion rings. Ate a plate of onion rings and then needed to nap in sort of a coma-like state before the show. Nothing like loading up on fried food and bread before you have to do an hour and a half show. I did go over to Empire Music, though. That did happen. I did go over to Empire Music, you know, and I was just hoping with all my heart that they did not have a guitar I wanted. I know that's weird. It's like you ride that edge where you're sort of like, you know, I don't need any more guitars. I want to get rid of guitars, but I kind of want this guitar. And if they have it, because I did sell out the show the night before and I deserve something, right? I'll probably buy it. And you get there and you're like, thank God, no old guitars that I want that I don't need. It's funny. I just, my buddy Dean Falcone from over there in New Haven, the pizza guy, the guy who hooks me up with pizza and music of different kinds, he told me that Pepe's Pizza, that's one of the New Haven pizzas, is actually doing a introducing the Paul Giamatti pie, but it's only on Sunday, March 10th. But that's at Pepe's in New Haven. In New Haven, wow, they're gonna love that, New Haven. And it's got a little picture of Paul holding a pizza. He doesn't know that, but I did text it to him. I texted, I said, I hope you snag that thing tonight, the Oscar. But if you don't, you know you'll always have this, the Paul Giamatti pie at Pepe's in New Haven, Connecticut. Okay, look, Thurston Moore, this was kind of an amazing interview. If you're interested in music, in modern music, in New York City, in Sonic Youth, in Patti Smith, in that whole era, it was a joy to talk to him. Sonic Life, a memoir, is now available wherever you get books, and it's a good read. This is me talking to Thurston Moore.
Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. So we did. I'll tell you what happened. We met. It was probably 2007. I think it was the release of, I don't know which solo record. What would that have been?
Well, for me, it could have been 2007? 2000, yeah. Trees Outside the Academy. There, yeah. And then, because Sonic Youth was still in business in 2007.
Well, I feel like it was a solo record.
Yeah.
And I was hosting a show at KTLK late at night. It was a disaster. I was not happy. And you came in as a guest. And I remember I felt like I immediately offended you. Because of my lack of knowledge about, sort of noise rock.
Okay.
Now, because the only thing that I could bring up for some reason was My Bloody Valentine, and right. You were just sort of like, well, all right.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, no, I'm not saying you were wrong.
No.
But I didn't have Sonic Youth or you in proper perspective.
You weren't going deep into, like, the noise rock canon.
I was not. No, I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't get up to speed. But I'll be honest with you. So I read. This is funny because I've read a lot of the book.
Yeah,
and I'm literally right around the part where you meet Kim. So spoiler alert: I heard you start a band, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But it's great because this time I'm well versed in all of it.
Well, you certainly, if you got to that part, you kind of can see, like, where we're at as far as, like, wanting to sort of employ noise guitars.
What I was fascinated with, because I lived in New York, I guess I got down there. I was second between A and B, 89. So it was done, really, by the time I got there.
It was definitely heading into high real estate territory at
right.
that time.
Beginning, yeah.
The 90s really get yupped out
right.
around that area.
Because, like, when I was there, you still had the kind of ongoing homeless flea market, from, like, 4th all the way to Tompkins Square. I was there when the band shell came down, the squatter protests.
People selling stuff on cardboard on the street.
Oh, yeah. All kinds of.
All day, every day.
Yeah, appliances that you hadn't seen in a while. Things you didn't know what they did.
Yeah, things things from the back of your friend's car who was visiting you the
night before. But I thought what was great about sort of leading up to what you became was that there was, you're 5 years older than me. So the difference between being 15 and in 73 and 15 and 76,
yeah,
music-wise,
yeah,
is big.
Oh, yeah. And people who are who are 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
And then they were in New York from like 71.
Right.
70, like they kind of they made that transition from wherever they came from.
Right.
Most people in our scene who come to New York, you come to New York. The ones who grew up in New York are rare, or you're part of a different scene.
Yeah.
Punk music in New York was never really that indigenous. Hardcore punk was more indigenous. It was like kids coming out of Brooklyn, Queens, and Bronx.
Right.
What have you. But Manhattan, like, the kids were coming out of art school.
Well, that was what was cool. And also, like, you know, going back to where you grew up and stuff, that all the way through the book, you know, despite whatever your feelings were about the music you grew up with or even the music that was, you know, going on around you in New York that you, you know, kind of moved past, is that you yourself always refer to wanting to be in a rock and roll band.
Yeah, definitely.
So the idea that, you know, rock and roll, that you had to almost come around to it, you know, after the period of art.
I guess so. I mean, to me, it like punk rock was experimental rock and roll music, you know, because the Ramones were a straight up rock and roll band, but they were kind of high concept.
Okay.
You know, there was like this there was this total idea behind it that was very artful.
Yeah.
You know,
dressing
the same, taking the same last name.
Right.
And Patti Smith was like she was a poet and a painter as well as being a vocalist and a lyricist and, you know, and a performer, you know. And it's just like, so you always had the sense that art was part of the rock and roll thing. But you sort of had these intellectual types on the same stage as these kind of street rockers like Johnny Thunders.
Right,
and,
you know,
and that collaboration to me was always fascinating. And that always, for me, is what defined whatever that was, punk rock, et cetera. So Malcolm McLaren with the Sex Pistols, he's like a university-educated, you know, provocateur, you know, and he has these ideas.
He's a brand manager.
Yeah. And so he's like, oh, let's have a band represent the store. Wouldn't that be cool? Like, in a band that's sort of like what I saw in New York around, like, Richard Hell and New York Dolls and stuff.
Yeah.
What could that be? It's like, well, how about the kids who come in here and rip shit off?
Right.
You know, like Steve Jones and Sid Vicious and, let's get them to be like the representatives. That would be so cool, like the street rats.
Yeah.
Know? So that collaboration between this kind of high-mindedness and this kind of street, this kind of street vibe, that to me was like really, that was really curious. It was a certain kind of blurring of class distinction, or at least a coming together.
Right.
You know, that was really exciting and it created fireworks.
But what was interesting to me is that you're coming, you know, you primarily grew up in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So you had that proximity.
Yeah.
And I mean, your dad was a music guy.
My dad was a music guy, and he was a education guy. You know, mom was a homemaker. But, you know, I was sort of living in rural Connecticut, and I was attracted to everything, you know, whether it was kind of like dumb rock Kiss or if it was like kind of like this is kind of more like smarty pants music like Genesis or something.
Yeah,
so
or
to
Yes.
Me, it was all,
you talk
to
about
me,
the,
yeah, it was
the problem with Yes.
Yeah. The problem with Yes. Just say no to Yes.
But that was happening when you were a kid. I like that there's, you know, I do this sometimes. I just wanted to be up to speed. But there's this point where your mind is kind of changing and you're spending time in New York. And then you go back home to, you know, the townie world. I mean, you had that one friend who was with you and your partner in crime.
Harold.
Yeah, but still you'd go back and then somehow you get caught up with, you know, some like ne'er-do-well.
Yes.
And you still like, you know, you still got to deal with Aerosmith. You still got to deal with Kiss.
Yeah.
And you liked them.
I liked it. And I liked the idea of trouble, you know. Trouble was rock and roll to me.
Right.
You know, it was on the edge. You're kind of like, you know, fucking the system a little bit.
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
Did you watch Keith's cover of I'm Waiting for My Man?
I did.
And?
It's amazing.
Right?
Beautiful.
It's great.
It's beautiful. Really genuine.
Yeah, I've watched it like four or five times.
Yeah.
And like who else deserves that song more than him?
Exactly. It's almost as if Lou had written that for like Keith Richards. You know?
And the weird thing is that Keith, I guess he gets credit. I mean, certainly through Johnny Thunders and those guys and the New York Dolls. But I ended up in a rabbit hole where I'm watching the Stones at the Marquee Club in 71 doing Midnight Rambler.
Yeah.
And Keith looks like he's about to die.
Yeah.
And like, he's so raw and weird. And like, I don't know. Do you think he gets the amount of credit he deserves?
He transcends everything in the history of rock and roll
right.
music. You know, like when punk rock starts happening in 76 and it's just like drawing a line and a wall of anything that happens before, very few people before that can actually sort of be accepted. And it's certainly – the Stones, funnily enough, are accepted only because of Keith.
Of course.
You know, but of course Iggy and Bowie and Mark Bolan.
Right.
You know,
these
guys are okay. They're safe. You know, they define so much of what's going on. But – Keith always did. Look at Patty. She
totally
cut Keith. Her hair just looked like Keith Richards.
Right. And also, I don't think the New York Dolls know how to dress without the Stones.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But like, I like the idea that you were open-minded enough. And I think this is important history, you know, heading into what becomes Sonic Youth, is that, you know, what was going on in New York when I get there in 89 was just the fumes of what, you know, you lived through. In a way.
89 is weird because, you're transiting into the 90s. And the 90s is when we start getting, like, kind of
big.
Like major label.
Right.
And then we start getting this profile. And, of course, the Nova of Nirvana's Nevermind in, like, what is that, 91, 92.
They owe a complete debt to you. I mean, I think literally, right? Didn't you broker that deal somehow?
Yeah. So, well, yeah. But everything changes there. It's a different world. But I think downtown New York City in 89, I mean, it's still kind of – interesting. When I was doing this book, I had to do a lot of research in library.
Into you?
No, I had to go to the library and get microfiche.
Microfiche, really? Still around?
It's still around.
Village Voice and stuff?
Yeah, but it's dusty and musty.
Yeah.
And I had to go to there was only one library in the United States that had the entire run of the Village Voice on microfilm.
Where was that?
It was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Wild.
Yeah, I was calling like New York Public Library. It was during the pandemic, so a lot of libraries are closed. But the ones that answer were like, you know, it's criminal, but we don't have digital on these.
Florida things. Wasn't closed. Did you go down there?
Well, Florida was not closed. I know Florida, you know, the only reason I went to Florida is because Florida needs all the love they can get. So, you know.
I guess. You're a bigger man than me. I just canceled 3 dates there. I'm like, fuck it.
Well, Miami, I'm sort of down in Miami, and Miami is just like New York City. It doesn't really represent anything except
that's
for
true.
Itself.
You know? That's true. It's very unique. You know?
And it's a
and you have roots there, don't you?
I was born in South Miami, so yeah, my family was all around South Miami and Coral Gables and
still?
Coconut Grove.
Anybody?
A few people.
Oh, really?
A few people. So I went down there to help with my mother when she was passing, and she had a rental house down there.
Yeah.
And I kind of took it over, and my wife, Eva, fell in love with it.
So you kept it?
And I was like, oh, you can't really sell Miami to anybody, but if somebody falls in love with it, God bless them. And I was just like, you know, it's in my DNA already.
Yeah.
You know, when I go down there, it's like the iguanas and the lizards come out, and I'm like, yeah, I'm home, baby, you know. But it's also kind of a noise underground scene in Miami that's really intense.
Now?
Yeah, there's a guy there called Rat Bastard who's been there. He's as old as I am. He's born in 58.
Yeah.
And he's always been sort of like one of the main practitioners of like really underground noise music.
Yeah.
And he puts on the International Noise Conference every year in Miami.
Oh, I think I've heard of that. Yeah.
So hundreds of people show up and you can only play for 15 minutes, no laptops, usually no synthesizers.
Oh, just heavy equipment.
Just whatever you want to do as far as like making like unbridled noise. Yeah. And in Miami, the noise people down there are kind of more insane than the rest of the world. They're really into like taking their clothes off and running out into the street.
That's Florida.
And jumping on top of cop cars and with like microphones strapped to their genitals and stuff.
Important stuff.
Well, sounds pretty cool. You know, somebody's got to do it.
I have to like remember that's sort of what it's about is that, you know, there is, you know, with what you're describing, certainly in the book at the time, the sort of schism between, you know, what you see as these dirty punks that eventually just sort of become the tropes they were mocking and the artists is that, you know, even when it comes to noise or Glenn Branca, right, that there is a lofty element to it, that you believe you're witnessing art.
Well, I mean, somebody like Glenn Branca was really like intensively studying like radical ideas of composition that had come before him.
Yeah.
You know, and so he was very well versed in it. But a lot of it was all about being self-taught in a way.
Right.
You know, or coming out of some other discipline. I mean, he was coming out of – Glenn Branca was coming out of like experimental theater like in the early to mid-70s, you know.
In New York?
In Cambridge, uh-huh. In Massachusetts, coming down to New York. But then seeing like – Suicide,
right.
Vega on stage,
yeah.
Standing there, you know, like twitching as if he was just, you know, coming out of some kind of Vietnamese psychosis kind of hospital thing, and on stage and with a leather jacket that was like ripped down the side where the arm is just hanging off, and he's, you know, and Martin Rev is like playing like this just super like high volume kind of cheapo beatbox,
yeah.
To him, that was theater. You know,
right.
It was just
yeah.
like, it sounds great too, but he really got into
that had a big impact on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, he got into this idea of like the electric guitar, like being this instrument that can create these really magisterial pieces of like noise music.
Glenn was, yeah.
Glenn did. And,
yeah.
and then he got involved with other people who were more seriously involved with that kind of music, like Reese Chatham, you know, or other really marginal kind of. Musicians like Charlemagne Palestine, you know, playing.
But you were just a kid, right, when you moved down there?
I was a teenager. I mean, I moved there in 78. I was 20 in 78, so I was kind of—
You started going down in your teens.
Kind of getting hair on my chin.
Yeah.
I started going down there when I was like 17, 18.
And
the late 76 is like when I first went.
But like what was it— Because like when like for me like I know a lot of the references and I don't know that particular scene in terms of No Wave, but you know just the idea that you were open minded enough or you were or that you know I was a bit too but you more so were still you, the things that we were judging art on and what was cool was still sort of post beatnik stuff,
yeah.
Right? So you know just the fact that. You know, Verlaine changed his name for a reason. You knew about Patti's love of Rimbaud. And this is stuff that, you know, I don't know if anyone knows about that stuff anymore.
But I was reading about it.
Yeah.
There was magazines. There was rock mags.
Yeah.
And they were at the local supermarket. They weren't that hard to find.
Cream
especially. And then even more kind of had a more commercial profile was like Circus.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And
I remember.
Circus had a side magazine called Circus Raves
because
they couldn't get it. There wasn't enough room in Circus, so they needed more real estate, and they created like another magazine, Hit Parader, which was like basically geared about like the lyrics to songs on the radio, but it would have information on weird Patti Smith, weird stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But a lot of it had the same New York editors, like people like Lisa and Richard Robinson, and they were there in the scrum. So like Lou Reed was like kind of hanging out at their place and writing songs and showing them the new songs he has for this record called Transformer and post Velvet Underground. So there was always a kind of this downtown New York hip scene around the Warhol Velvet Underground thing that was kind of infiltrating these magazines because these writers were pretty cool.
Right.
And so when Lester Bangs, who's like a huge fan of like Iggy Stooge and Iggy Pop and that and music that was – I mean Iggy and the Stooges are – they weren't selling records. You know, nobody was buying Stooges
like
records.
In 1970?
They probably sold 9 records.
For the first
one? But it was famously like the 9 people who bought it like started bands and those people started bands. Those people started bands. That's the whole Eno kind of math, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, those magazines are super important. And to me, those writers, specifically like Lester Bangs, Patti was a writer.
Right.
Richard Meltzer was a writer. And these guys, these people, how they were writing, their energy was the same energy that I wanted to hear in this music. And they were writing about this band called the New York Dolls
or
this band called the Dictators, you know, or this band called the Ramones. I was like, what did this sound like? The records were hard to find.
Even in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah. Finding a Stooges record was impossible. That first Stooges record was only available in the Woolworth's cutout bin. And so there'd be like 20 of them with a corner cut off.
Yeah.
And there were 49 cents. And I would look at it every once in a while and go like, is this really worth 49 cents?
And it was a label release.
It was an Elektra record.
Yeah.
But nobody bought it. It was immediately discontinued. And so I remember like putting down my 2 quarters and going home and just thinking like, what the fuck is this? You know, because it was like, it was completely
monotonous.
The first
one.
The first one. It was like every song sounded like this kind of monotone like fuzz and kind of bored. And like, But I was fascinated by it and kept going back to it. And when friends would come over and we'd play records,
yeah,
and they wanted to hear Emerson, yes, Lake and Palmer, and I'd put that on. They would look at me like, what is this garbage? You know, like, what are you, like?
But you were infected with it.
I love something about it. I love the attitude of it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And I love its otherness.
Right.
And it was subversive. And for some reason, I write in the book a little bit about trying to analyze, like, why did the subversive attract us?
Yeah.
Or me or you or whatever. And it's like, why does that lead you to New York? And it's like, I had a middle class, rural upbringing.
Sure.
It was safe. The house was safe. My father wasn't hitting us. You know?
Yeah.
Well, not much.
Yeah. But,
only when necessary. You know, it was like old school, the belt, you know, the kind of thing. But no, there was no abuse in my house. It was loving. My mother was a Catholic, you know, taking us to church until we stopped.
And well, I think also there's the idea that, like, subversion in the suburbs, which you talk about a bit, is that, you know, it's just like causing trouble, you know, being a little vandal, drinking, driving around.
Yeah.
Even that has a status quo to it.
Yeah.
So something like New York and Iggy and the Stooges, you're like, holy fuck, there's a whole other world.
Right.
That I don't even understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's compelling.
When you hear about the Stooges, like, you know, the singer's like pouring hot wax over his body at Max's Kansas City. I want to see that. You know, I saw Rick Wakeman in his cape doing the fucking King Charles and his court.
Right.
You know, it was like one of the big concerts I went to. And I was really excited. I had the record or I had the A-track or whatever.
Yeah.
I knew every note.
Yeah.
And then I went there and I was like, this is really interminable. This is like, and it was packed, you know. It was like a sold out, like, arena concert. And I was like, this is boring.
Yeah. I don't know why I never, even as a kid, you know, in like in high school in 78 or whatever, I could never wrap my brain around. There was one Emerson, Lake and Palmer. There's one Yes song. In and around the lake. I just like the rock part. I'm like, that's the best part of that song.
Yeah, yeah.
The rest I could do without. And I've tried to go back. I can't do it. I can't do Genesis. I can't do Rush.
I mean, that's the thing. A lot of it was like people our age, like, being attracted to punk rock because it was kind of fetishizing the best parts of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Getting rid of all the other claptrap.
Exactly.
You know? So, that part in the Yes roundabout, it's just like, just play that really fast, but just that part over and over again. And you're like,
that's it. Then
sing
we
about,
got it.
Sing about killing the president or something.
Yeah. But that was it. That fucking, you don't need four chords max.
Yeah.
Max. Got too complicated.
Yeah, but but at the same time,
you don't mention the Beatles once.
Well, the Beatles, I don't mention the Beatles once.
Maybe once.
Wow, maybe it got edited out. I don't mention the Beatles at
all.
Really.
It's
okay. The Beatles, the Beatles are such an text to everything.
Well, that's right. It's almost like Christmas songs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just like
they're
like mentioning the air that you breathe.
Exactly.
It's like, it is like Christmas songs. I mean, the Beatles to me were like reviewing the Beatles catalog through the 60s. There's a lot of nursery rhyme action going on there. I think it really appealed to that kind of arrested infantilism that we all have,
sexual repression,
possibly
out of the 50s, but you also, the Christmas songs in the way they're just dug in, you don't even know how, but you know all of the songs,
right?
And they're just there, and they're not seasonal, but occasionally they pop up. But it was kind of wild to watch that. Did you watch that Get Back documentary?
Totally.
It was fucking crazy.
Yeah, it was one of the great bird's eye views of all time of something so perennial like that.
Because none of these guys have personalities in your mind, really. And then when you see them interacting as people, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
They're human and
they're
magic.
Just like us.
Yeah, yeah.
Celebrities, they're just like us.
Yeah.
So I always one thing that really stuck with me in some earlier Beatles doc was Paul just saying, like, we were just a cracking good rock band. You know, that's what he said. Like, we really could swing together.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was that Hamburg Club stuff, and I heard this thing. I really need to get it validated that they were just hopped up on surplus Nazi speed.
Oh.
Because the owner had a bunch.
Wow.
And that makes sense. If you watch that footage of them, just going at it.
Yeah.
So they put in all those hours.
Yeah,
jacked.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, no, they were inspired by all kinds of information.
That's for sure.
And then they learned songwriting from, they learned songwriting from the ground up. I mean, they were listening to
Everly Brothers, Chuck Berry. right?
Exactly, which was kind of new to them as 19, 20-year-olds.
Well, yeah, because 57, that's the beginning, right?
Right.
And they're in the early 60s, it was like they were close to the source.
They were indeed. And, you know, I think, you know, Paul's musicality is very – is extremely obvious. He's just like he's completely gifted. I mean, the guy is –
Oh, yeah, of course.
Know,
the
voice, his sense of melody.
Yeah.
John's rock and roll.
Yeah. Raw shit.
Raw shit. That collaboration is just – is gold.
So when you, when you start going down there to New York from the suburbs, you know, you see Patty –
Well, not familiar.
No. But the first time you see her, because I've interviewed her and she let me play with her once.
Yeah.
And it was like one of the biggest nights of my life.
Yeah.
Even
I played music with her and I've hung out with her and talked.
Now, yeah. But when you first saw her, what the fuck was that? Yeah. Like?
I really wanted to see her. My interest was that she was a music journalist who her writing was like really distinctive from any other journalist. It was all lowercase and prosaic, and it was all about celebrating the music and the record that she was talking about. And she was never – her critique was all about sort of this elevation. It had nothing to do with like parsing any other data of the record that like a male rock critic would do or whatever.
Yeah.
But so she was super interesting and very very evocative and made you want to hear this music that she was championing. And so when she did Hey Joe – Piss Factory 7-inch in late 75, whenever it came out, and I saw an ad for it in like one of those magazines.
Yeah,
I immediately sent away for it. But I wanted to hear what does a rock writer sound like on a record. You know, like how audacious is that a rock writer is actually going into the pantheon of which they write about.
Yeah,
you know, I thought that was rather kind of an interesting kind of transition. So, and the record was amazing.
Right.
You know, I remember getting it, and it was just like unlike anything else I had ever heard. It was so like plaintive and simple.
Yeah,
and it kind of like build up on this kind of scratchy guitar thing. You know, Tom Verlaine is like playing this kind of freeform, you know, scattershot guitar style.
He's a monster guitar player, isn't he?
So yeah, so I mean, there's all these things going on this record that are so singular to me and so astounding. And the quality of her voice, the recitation on Piss Factory, this poem, you know, that's what I wanted to write about. The book was basically, I want to write about these documents. I want to write about these signifiers that define so much of what a kid like me goes towards, you know, and all through his adulthood, even now.
Yeah,
know?
Sure.
And so, yeah, seeing Patty for the first time, I wanted to, but, you know, we were also teenagers. Like, well, how do you get in your car and go to this, like, abstract place in New York City?
I just didn't know.
But then we found out she was playing at Westport, Connecticut, at the Westport County Playhouse, which was an hour away.
Right.
And we jumped in a car and went. And it was right before Horses came out.
Oh, yeah.
And she came out, and the band came out, and they started raving up into the Velvet Underground's We're Gonna Have a Real Good Time Together.
Great song.
She had a leather jacket on, came out chewing gum, took the leather jacket off and threw it on the drum stand and just went for it. And that whole concert was amazing.
It must have been great.
And I was sitting there with my friend, and my friend, Harold, actually got up to dance, do a little boogie, and like some security guy came over and was like, "Hey, you can't stand up." I was like, "Are you like?" I knew right then, like, "Oh, this has to change.
This is Westport.
This has to change. Yeah, this is Westport. This is Westport, not L.A."
Yeah. Well, that I just like those moments, and you had a few of them. I mean, you know, I had not really put Wayne County into any sort of perspective, and how important he was down there.
Super important.
Yeah.
Even Lydia Lunch says when she was a teenager and she ran off to New York City in like 76.
Yeah.
She said she immediately saw Wayne County DJing at Max's Kansas City, and she went up to him and said, "I need a place to stay." And he's like, "You can stay with me, honey." You know, he was a friend to all, and a friend, and he understood like these young subversives coming to town, and he was like, going to protect them. And Wayne County was super important, you know, coming out of the
as a performer and
as
a DJ?
Performer, just sort of as somebody who was like just kicking down any door in the way, you know. It was a transsexual rock and roller, you know, like, and really funny, really bawdy, you know, and writing good songs. "You Make Me Cream in My Jeans," a great rock and roll too.
Sure, and also, then there's the Suicide experience,
and then Suicide, who had been performing since at least like 69, 70, yeah. you know, like in like weird little hovels. They would like play in these kind of anti-war kind of hangouts, you know, that the hippies would yeah. sort of like on Houston Street and Broadway.
Yeah.
You know, that New York at that time was kind of like – it was kind of a little dirty, little
– broken down.
Broken down town.
It was broke.
It was definitely broke. So you had – you know, you sort of had this cretinous kind of like really sort of city hippie, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a country hippie. You
right.
know? It was like
yeah, yeah.
free-flowing skirts and listening to Joni Mitchell play acoustic guitar by the pond.
No, it was this weird kind of collector hippie.
Yeah, it's like
the 10,000
it was like a Pettibone
record.
Drawing of the hippie. It's like wash his other hand, you know. Yeah. He's a peace sign in one hand, his fist in the other kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of that vibe.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're those weird kind of like New York hippie nerds that seem to be living in their little cave apartments with all kinds of ephemera.
Even moving there in 76, 77, 78, that whole period right there, there was that last vestige of hippie culture that was just like walking up and down St. Mark Street, like super burnt out.
Yeah.
You would see cult leaders sometimes in flowing white robes that were dirty on the bottom and like kind of bedraggled speed freaks following them around.
Yeah.
For a while, you would see that.
Yeah.
And then they kind of, where'd they all go?
Yeah.
They left town because... I don't know, Trash and Vaudeville opened up or something.
I don't know where they all go, but when I go there after living down where I did and near where you used to live, like it's interesting when you see, because I go back infrequently, but I walk around the same blocks.
Yeah.
And every once in a while you see some 75-year-old dude, you're like, oh shit,
yeah.
he's still walking around that guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's kind of great.
Yeah.
You're like, you know, in their like saggy leather pants.
Right, right. Like, what did they see?
What
like,
are they what doing? They
I talked to Jan Deck, who's like the Texas singer-songwriter who put out hundreds of albums, and nobody knew who he was because he never made an appearance, and you had to send away for these records, and he was a real mystery. And then he finally, a few years ago, came out and played, and he's my age. He's a really tall, gaunt Texas guy who always wears this kind of same kind of hat.
Yeah.
Same kind of – he kind of dressed like Richard Lewis a little bit,
black.
Kind of black, all black. And I played with him, and we were talking about, I was like, how's Texas, blah, blah, blah. He goes, well, I used to live in New York in 72 and 73, but then I moved back to Texas.
Huh.
And I was like, Jandek, I was like, you lived in New York in 72, 73 in the Lower East Side. I said, you must have seen like, you know, Patty at the St. Mark's Poetry Project with Lenny Kaye and the New York Dolls getting their thing together at Mercer Arts Center. And
That burnt down, right?
Yeah. And I was like, that must have been an amazing time. And he just looked at me and said, I saw nothing. And that's kind of, I think, really what is the most common kind of experience for a lot of people. It's like, you don't know really what's going on. And if you do, you're lucky. But when I was living there, it's like, there's so much stuff that did happen at the Poetry Project. I wish I could go back in time and walk up the street and experience it. I wish I could have walked up the street and seen all this free jazz and avant-garde jazz.
And so that was all happening. And you missed a lot of it?
It was all in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
But I was only interested in like trying to catch, you know, the Ramones and Patti Smith. And even No Wave, I was like kind of taken affront by. These were people my age who were kind of making these pronouncements like, oh, you know, Patti Smith's a barefoot hippie. We're not interested in television. The guitar solos are too long.
But this is a year after it started.
I know. They're already attacking, like, the sacred animal. I was just like, no, you can't do that.
That's the amazing thing about the book and also about the history of it is that, you know, the resistance to what was this new thing happened almost immediately.
Yeah, by these really, like, freakos coming in from wherever. I mean, Lydia comes out from Rochester. James Chance comes in from
Ohio.
He comes in from Minneapolis, I think. And then like all this Cleveland people come in. There's this Florida contingent. And they all find each other in the streets, and they're real ragamuffin. And they start playing music without knowing anything about playing music, more so than – at least, the Ramones knew some bar chords. Patti Smith Group was basically an accomplished bar rock band with like a really amazing singer.
Yeah.
Blondie Group – they kind of knew how to play.
Yeah.
You know, Talking Heads, you know, taught themselves, like, you know, tropes of, like, how to actually play. Teenage Jesus and the Jerks and the Contortions and DNA, these guys picked up a guitar that morning and, like, did a gig that night without knowing anything.
But that appealed
to me. And it sounded great. It appealed to me because I thought that was, like, why not have it be the most brutally new language ever and, like, have it just dispel anything that kind of can inform it except for your own heart.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, there's I think I underlined like one thing, which is not unusual for me in the book. And it was like around, you know, you're thinking about that. Oh, here you go. Inspired by the sounds I'd been consuming and that had been gestating inside me, I start thinking that with my electric guitar, I might dispense with any reliance on traditional notes and chords in favor of wild and scattershot noises I could create along with the instrument's neck. I began to see music not just as something composed, but as sounds that could be created spontaneously if the right sense of openness could be conjured, the mind freed to the possibilities of chance and magic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's sort of...
I couldn't have said it better. I forgot I wrote that. That's pretty good.
Well, that's
why... I have to read that book someday.
Yeah, it's a pretty good book. This guy Thurston Moore wrote it. But it was before. It was, I mean, obviously when you're looking back on this stuff, you can realize, you know, kind of put intellectual ideas into what was just a kind of yearning.
Yeah.
But you know, that seems to make sense. That, but also, oddly, I'm getting excited for reasons, is that... Really, that's the difference. Like, even with basic rock and roll, what the difference between a bar band and a genius is making it your own.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's always been the weird kind of magic of it, this three chord shit.
Right.
But it's sort of like, why is Johnny Thunder so fucking amazing? Because there's nobody like that guy.
There's nobody like that guy. Nobody can play that E chord the way
right,
he plays that E.
Yeah.
There's a certain thing he does. That he always does in just about every song, where it's just like, there's this kind of bending of the A minor or something, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I can do it. I've seen other people do it, but nobody sounds like Johnny Thunder's doing it.
Right.
Nobody sounds like Johnny Ramone with his downstroke.
Right.
You know, I can play bar chords all day long with that downstroke. Johnny Ramone's like swing with that, or Ron Ashton from the Stooges.
Oh my God!
I sat across from Ron Ashton when we were doing music for Velvet Goldmine, and it was like the most amazing crash course in like what not to do when you're doing a Stooges song, because everybody plays Stooges songs, covers them. It's a real sort of bombastic kind of pummeling thing.
Yeah,
it's not. He's like swinging. He's like jazz. He's a little. And his brother Scott, the way he played drums, he was never just like pounding. He was behind the beat, like just blues playing.
Yeah.
So that's
sure.
The Stooges were like an electric blues band.
Of course.
You know, they weren't, I mean, the whole punk thing was like, maybe that was from Iggy's delivery and maybe that was from the fuzz box Ron was using. But other than that, man, they were like a greasy blues.
Sure.
Like,
it was that drive. It was that drive of that guitar. So when you started the Coachmen, what were you guys playing exactly?
Those guys were a little bit older. They were coming out of Rhode Island School of Design. They were the class after like David Byrne and Chris Franks and Tina Weymouth. And those guys had already been in New York for a couple of years. And these guys floundered around the RISD campus, and they were doing different like music things. And they finally make their way down to New York City to follow in the footsteps of their friends who came out of the school. Most successfully, the Talking Heads.
Right.
I just ran into one of those guys at a record store in New Haven, Connecticut, and we exchanged numbers. It was just as easy as that.
Yeah.
He was looking in the Velvet Underground bin, and there was nothing in it. I mean, it was empty. And I was just like, wow, you know, it says Velvet Underground, but there's no records, which was, you know, that's a very common thing in these record stores. You couldn't find these cool records because they were gone.
And you also talked about the beginning of zines, which got everybody kind of locked in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The zines were really important. And in that era of fanzines that were precursors to the punk rock explosion of fanzines that you would find stacked up at Rough Trade Records in London or Bleecker Bobs or whatever in New York, there was a precursor to it where you had these like people who were reading Lester Bangs and Patti Smith and Richard Meltzer creating their own fanzines. There was actually one that some rock writers had put together. It was actually called Punk before there was Punk Magazine. It was a punk newspaper.
Not McNeil, not Legs.
It was before Legs, you know, and so that's kind of interesting. But there was that period of fanzine culture that predates punk from like sort of 70 to 75 is super interesting. Byron Coley, the rock writer, and I have been always toying with this idea of doing some kind of book that sort of covers that period of underground rock fanzines, because they're really cool, because that's where a lot of people our age before punk were discovering Bloister Cult or you know, the Dictators or the Dolls.
Yeah.
They were actually getting interviews with these bands that the mainstream press wasn't dealing with at all.
Sure.
Kim Fowley.
You know,
Kim Fowley was just like, who's this guy? You know, it's like, why is he making this crazy record called Outrageous? You know,
it's a crazy record.
It's one of the greatest records of all time. Concept record about paranoid hippie, like the cops beating down the door. Fantastic.
Oh, and you wrote about seeing the Runaways, and you were really electrified by them.
One of the best rock and roll bands ever.
Yeah.
In the world.
Yeah.
You know, to this day.
And you saw them at CB's?
I saw them at CBGB, and I saw them at the Palladium opening for the Ramones.
Oh, man.
And both times they were just incredible.
But the Coachman, well, that was your first gig where you got on stage, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they were not – was it satisfying music for you?
In some ways, it became satisfying. At first, I was kind of like sort of a satellite player, and they were like, well, you can play on these four songs, but these other songs, we already have something going on, and it doesn't necessitate a second guitar. You know, it was very loosey-goosey. Nobody knew anybody. Nobody knew the Coachman. I mean, the Coachman didn't have a name or anything. And we would play at art lofts that were places where like these kind of Rhode Island School of Design crowd hung out. The first gig I played – the audience was like maybe 30 people. It was people building around, like talking to each other while we played. Yeah. But it was like, it was David Byrne and his friends. You know,
right.
It was like, that was the audience. I've met David Byrne a couple of times. I've never said like, you know, by the way, you were at the very first gig I ever played. But he wouldn't remember that. But he would remember the other people who were there.
Sure.
You know.
Well, yeah, that was the mixing of the scenes and the entry into the art world that's fascinating. Like in the book, we can't go into it, but as a history and a document of witness of that period in New York, it's fucking amazing.
Oh, that's cool.
I mean, like the living situation. That feeling, because I lived on Second between A and B in 89, and there was still that feeling of sort of like, I remember the one time I couldn't find a parking space, so I parked in front of the thing next door, which I knew was a drug thing, and I knew they had lookouts and stuff.
Man.
And I got out, and there were four dudes in my car just going through shit. I walk out, my tires were flat. And the dudes who did it were standing right there. Because they knew I shouldn't park there. No one parks there.
Yeah.
But I was late. It was late at night. So the tires are flat. And I asked one of them, is there a place I can get tires? And I go around the corner to talk to someone about tires. I come back. They're all in my car going through my glove compartment. And you just see nothing you can do.
There's nothing you can do.
It was like the guy was plugging into your wall.
Yeah, he's like, you shouldn't live here. So you shouldn't live here. I was like, but I do. I mean, it's like, what am I supposed to do? Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to talk about what life was like on 13th Street between A and B in 1979. That to me was really something I felt like I could be even more of an eyewitness to and make it come alive, more so than like seeing whatever gigs or whatever kind of like quote unquote famous people like I had interactions with.
Yeah.
I didn't find that so interesting to talk about, especially because there's people my age, younger and older, who have way more experiences with interactions with, like, you know, celebrated individuals and the geniuses who walk among us. And it's just like, well, there's a few people that I kind of like, I did a color Xerox for Jean-Michel Basquiat, big deal.
But you saw him in his musician.
Yeah, but, you
weren't buddies.
Yeah, but I have good friends who, like, you know, slept with the guy. You know? So it's like, I don't have anything. that's the book.
It was always pretty exciting. Yeah. I mean, even in the 90s, I remember my Coke dealer lived between B and C on like 7th, and he kind of managed the building. And anytime I go up there, it was like some sort of weird salon of has-beens and it was wild, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But so what happens, like, I know, well, you know, there's a lot of experiences you talk about with people, and you're kind of coming of age around, you know, gender stuff and violence and all kinds of things. But like when you meet Kim, it wasn't an immediate musical partnership.
It was actually.
Yeah.
Because I was already playing with this woman who was a very good friend of hers. And this woman was part of she was an integral part of the no wave scene. She was playing with Rhys Chatham in different bands. She was playing in this band called Arsenal.
Yeah.
That it was her and Rhys Chatham. And this kind of like this anarchist singer-songwriter provocateur who relocated to San Francisco, whatever. But I started playing with her in 79.
Yeah.
And right when the Coachman was kind of disbanding for lack of any kind of like appreciation for what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so I started like kind of, by that point I had met some other people that were sort of a part of that society.
Who was
that,
it? Like
that community.
Swans?
Her name was, Swans come later.
Yeah.
But her name was Miranda.
Yeah.
And so I was working at a shipping job and I met her boyfriend who was like managing New Order for their U.S. dates, you know, after the Joy Division stopped because of you. And I was going to go see Joy Division, but he killed himself. And so all of a sudden New Order came. It was like this whole thing was happening all within a year's time.
Right.
That's another thing. It's like so much happened in like a 2-year period.
Like Sid died, public image happened.
Everything. I mean, people dying, bands beginning, the music ideas morphing into like a whole other thing, like from the Pistols to the Public Image Limited. You know, this is like within like 24 months. Like, there's so much goes down.
Right.
Like 78 to 80. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a wildfire of change. And so you're living kind of amidst that and you don't really think about it. You're not articulating that when you're there. It's just like happening and you know that you're in the right place.
Right.
So for me to be introduced to Kim through like one of her best friends, you got to meet my good friend Kim.
She's
probably really into like what you're doing, which was like this kind of freeform guitar stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and she was like, I can't really play with that, but I think she probably could because she's kind of into that. And she was already sort of ensconced with the downtown art scene. She drove out from LA with Mike Kelly, the artist.
Yeah.
They were a couple.
Mm.
And so he went back and she stayed. And then within a year's time, I kind of got connected to her. And we just started hanging out. Yeah, we became boyfriend, girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then I was already like, I want to have a band. And she had a practice amp, a bass amp that she got. And that was being used as a side table, like an end table. I was like, And so we just started like having this idea of playing. And then I met this other girl who I had there was no romance there,
right.
But she was really cool. And she was the girlfriend of Vito Acconci, this artist who was associated with Dan Graham, an artist that Kim was very close to. And that's how she got her apartment below his. And I think Dan Graham had some idea that, oh, well, maybe I could be boyfriend, girlfriend with this young, art girl.
But yeah.
I kind of stepped in and screwed all that up.
Yeah.
You know, but me and Dan eventually became very good friends. And the three of us became a bit of part of this whole art world downtown and our band developed. That's what I kind of tried to try to write about and parse in the book about the beginning of Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
Like, you know. So.
Well, I mean, but who were the bands like and who were the artists like when it was all happening, when you guys started to come together, the other bands that were of your ilk?
Well, it's interesting because when I met Lee and Kim, Lee was already playing with Glenn Branca.
Yeah.
Lee's had a band himself that was kind of odd and they kind of played with the Coachman at CBGB and we kind of fell into each other and we'd go see each other's band.
Yeah.
When I met Kim, she was playing music with a no wave, a woman named Nina Cannell, who was in a band called Ut. And so she was involved and they were playing really kind of just abstract, almost anti-music kind of, but they were songs. I mean, I shouldn't say anti-music. It was all music. But neither she nor I really knew how to play proper guitar.
So you had no theory behind it.
I knew how to play E chords and D chords.
Sure.
But I had no desire to play covers. So I never really, a lot of that logic I didn't really get into. I just wanted to write songs with however I could. The first Sonic Youth album is all standard tuning. It's the only one.
Yeah.
So that's how that began.
But when you're just like, when you're noodling around on a guitar without having any sort of background in, open tunings, or necessarily any theory. So when you're just coming up with these almost dissonant kind of riffs, you're just feeling it out.
Feeling it out.
Yeah.
I was never noodling, by the way.
What's the other word?
It's John Coltrane noodle?
No.
And that's another thing is like when I started playing with Kim.
Riffing.
Kim had this whole background of jazz appreciation, which I had yet to experience.
Oh, yeah.
So that was interesting. And I think that aesthetic.
What part of jazz? Abstract?
Just, I think that, no, noise. Coltrane, Mingus, classic impulse record stuff.
Sure.
And I think that, but just the aesthetics of that music, I think was already had informed her intellectually, whereas I had yet to get there with that.
Right.
And that was in retrospect, I can see how that was important. Lee was coming out of like a lot. He was a practiced guitarist who listened to the Grateful Dead before punk rock.
Sure.
And he knew how to play like, you know, kind of
Mixolydian.
He could do some
country grooves.
Exactly. Yeah. He could pull that out.
Yeah.
He could sing in tune. He is a very pitch perfect singer. Kim and I just opened our mouths and let it bleed.
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
So there was that kind of thing with Lee's more sort of the traditional technique.
Yeah.
And our kind of completely lack of. It was kind of interesting. And well, our first drummer was kind of also primal and self-taught. It wasn't until Steve Shelley joined where he actually brought like.
Well, that's
more
what I was going to say. That was a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, Shelley, you know, like, changed the game.
He changes the game quite a bit because he, in some ways, he makes us a bit more sort of accessible.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Which is like, you could say it's for better or for worse. I thought it was for better because we had to sort of progress somehow. Otherwise, we would just sort of be locked into this kind of, you know.
Almost a boutique act.
Yeah. You know,
yeah, like an art act.
Yeah. But even like later when doing some solo work or Kim and Julie Kafritz would do Free Kitten, people would say like, oh, they're pretending how not to play or something. It's like, no, they really know how not to play.
<It's> not, they almost invented it. Well, that's what's interesting because like Bad Moon Rising gets like a lot of attention, but it doesn't put you over the top.
Well, we're just sort of feeling our way into sort of more traditional tropes and trying to employ them into
with the second
this
album.
Kind of more experimental music that we've been already fully into.
Right.
I mean, there's a musician in London that I really like named David Toop. He's a musicologist.
Yeah.
He's been around since the late 60s doing really interesting experimental music on the British scene. And he was around during the whole punk scene and digging it.
Yeah.
And I asked him about some of these bands. He said, you know, the best bands – by far were the ones who did not know how to play because they were the most interesting. They were like, those gigs were exciting because the music was entirely new.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So
to them too.
Yeah. Exactly. So we always wanted to keep that element.
Right.
As a central, aspect of Sonic Youth, you know, even though we would like started becoming more sophisticated in our own playing techniques and styles, we always wanted to keep that element as if we just pick up the instrument that morning.
Well, I mean, I think that, but that plays because like even being more sophisticated in your own, you know, methods, which were already a bit abstract. So you're just sort of mastering that.
Yeah.
So it is all kind of new.
We're seeing how far we can push it and still sort of get some kind of critical appraisal, you know. I mean, when critics started saying, getting excited by us, and that was really interesting because, I mean, at first we were sort of, you know, kind of people didn't really give us a time of day, you know, for a year or two. And then all of a sudden music writers started liking us.
But which album?
I would say Bad Moon Rising. Yeah.
Right, so
I say
the second record
that comes out, and a lot of it has to do with the British gentleman who released the record, Paul Smith, on Blast First, and he kind of tap danced on everybody's desk, and like listen to this band. And that was very.
Would you call that a concept record? Kind of.
It was definitely thematic. I mean, you know, the idea of having all the songs sort of bleed into each other with certain cassette tapes that we were using. And it originated from this idea of like we kept changing the tunings on the guitars between different songs and doing that live. There would be these 5-minute breaks between songs. It was before tuners. I think that the muted tuner doesn't really come in until like the late 80s. You know?
Yeah.
So if you listen to live recordings of Television or Jimi Hendrix or whatever, you always hear that between song like you're like tuning up. Yeah. I miss that. I really miss that. I always thought that was – it's like hearing, like going to the symphony orchestra and hearing like the tuning for 30 minutes before they start. That's the best part of the gig, man. That just sounds so cool. You know, but – so I really miss that.
Yeah.
But we decided like instead of having these like, you know, long like breaks where people just start, you know, like start heckling you. Like, come on. You know, do you have another song or not? We started playing cassette tapes through like a separate amplifier through like a Radio Shack cassette player.
Yeah.
And we would And we would sort of push people's buttons by getting the current hits of the day, where there was Pat Benatar.
Right.
You know, stop using sex as a weapon. That was a good one.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, or something really badass, like Run DMC's Jam Master jamming, you know, like was just blasting distortedly through an amp while you were tuning.
Right.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you also talk about a little bit about what else is going on in New York community-wise and different types of music and just how, you know, in some ways you were kind of insulated down in the village, but you knew that there was all this stuff in the boroughs going on.
There was, well, the stuff in the boroughs was mostly like this kind of half generation younger, as far as for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kim's 5 years older and Lee is, I think, 3 years older. And so I was kind of the young guy until Steve Shelley comes in. And I was always the young guy in my micro community of like these RISD college kids and just like on this scene. I was the 19-year-old. I was a 20-year-old. And so I was always the youngest guy until I was not.
Yeah.
You know, and then when the hardcore kids started coming up in the early 80s, like the Beastie Boys and Reagan Youth, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, you know, these guys are really young. They're like 17, 16, 17 years old. Minor Threat coming up from DC. And, and I just thought all those bands were amazing. But a lot of the people I had been playing with did not. They were like thinking like, punk died with Sid. I mean, why would anybody want to continue playing that form?
It all comes back around.
But I was like, it's not really, they're not really playing like Pistols punk or even Ramones punk. They're playing something else entirely.
Yeah.
It's like this, and it was this language of punk that they were trying to glean from Bad Brains, you know, which is an all African American band who really knew how to play, and they were kind of they already had done some jazz fusion time, and they heard the Ramones and other stuff, and they started writing songs that were punk rock and just destroying in DC. And then they decided to move to New York, and they just influenced every like 18-year-old kid who wanted to be a punk rocker. And so I talked to like the bass player Bert Kuros, who played with a lot of the DC hardcore bands. So what was that vocabulary that you guys had, where it was like doo 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 doo? It was like that kind of like skank groove.
Yeah,
and then it would go into like hyperspeed.
Yeah.
You know, with the hyper polka beat. You know, and he was like, it was us trying to play like the Bad Brains. We were just looking at them, looking at their hands, and copying them, and seeing like what would happen. And that exchange is insanely beautiful when you think about it.
Yeah,
in the context of like rock and roll history.
Yeah,
that this whole primarily white suburban male culture is taking information from this like just incredibly inspired African American,
and also hip hop too a little bit later. Yeah, that was coming in too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, so like throughout all the records, I mean, they're all, you know, different. But like, what made the difference for Daydream Nation, Goo, Dirty, that run?
Oh, well, certainly.
After was that SST?
Daydream Nation is sort of the last record we do. That record's transitional, where it's like we're stepping away from being on an independent label and going into like corporate record territory. So Paul Smith.
So was the expectation different in your mind?
I was hoping that by us making a double album, it would be regarded with the same critical fervor that Husker Du's Zen Arcade had and the Minutemen's Double Nickels on the Dime had.
Yeah.
Because they were double albums in a culture that was not about expansiveness. It was like quick, sharp shocks. And then the albums were just like, you know, there would be like 10 songs on each side. So for these guys to make double albums where they could stretch out, and Black Flag growing their hair out and wanting to make a double album called Everything Went Black, which was just like all this spurious music they had around. They had this idea of doing a record after Damage where it was all about side two, where they could actually stretch out, you know, long jams, because they were like listening to heavy metal like Dio, and they were listening to Grateful Dead as well as to their punk rock brothers. It was like kind of like it was a definitely interesting transitional period there. And we were not a hardcore band.
Yeah.
Even though I kind of adored it and I kind of tried to employ it into a lot of what Sonic Youth is doing, there was always resistance, I think, from the rest of the band. Like, we're not going to become a hardcore band.
Well, there's stuff on Goo that's pretty hard.
Yeah. So I had a sort of like temperate But I knew that we couldn't, you know, go out there and pretend that we were, you know, like some kind of like new minor threat style band because we were older.
Yeah.
And we had this art rock legacy. And so it's like, forget
about
it.
We had a sound.
Yeah. And I also knew that it was a bit thing like I didn't really – a lot of punk rock and hardcore was – there was like this disparity between like this like always in punk rock, this really sort of street tough kind of thing where it was anti-intellectualism going on. Only because it just like felt as if it was an affront to, you know, the genuine real deal, just like three chords and the truth kind of
thing. Well, so you're saying the guys like Ramones, Heartbreakers, Dead Boys, that stuff.
It was just like, yo, Vinny, like plug it in, like, you know, nah.
Right. And also you talked about like the sexuality of it was pretty straight and pretty
traditional. A lot of the sexuality of it was like boys who had yet to sort of lose their virginity. So they were all kind of like piling on top of each other in like big piles on stage, you know, which is just like,
And then Dope killed a lot of them too.
Dope killed it. And then when they all got laid, hardcore dissipates after everybody gets laid. I mean, it's just like it becomes Fugazi. Yeah.
It becomes family music. So like with that run, how big of a difference did Butch Vig make?
Oh, well, Butch Vig came to us because he did Nevermind. And before Nevermind really sort of started charting, we knew he had done that record. And the only reason that Nirvana used him is because he did like some hardcore records that they liked. And I was really into like some of those early Midwestern hardcore 7-inches that Butch had engineered, like particularly Mecht Mensch, which was the very first thing he ever did.
Yeah.
And so Nevermind sounded so good.
Did, right?
And
it was coming out of speakers everywhere.
I mean, but even before that, we had a cassette of it. And it's just like, oh, this sounds really good. And it was like Butch Vig. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, he's good. You know, Smart Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, whatever. And they went there and, you know, well, they actually did it in L.A.
Yeah.
With Butch. But they, I remember thinking like, oh, yeah, let's use Butch. I mean, it was only because he made that record sound good. And that record was like, became, as you know, Supernova. And then.
So he did Goo and Dirty?
He did Goo and Dirty, and so when we sent him cassettes of what we were working on for the songs on Goo, and they were just all over the place, rehearsal stuff, and he was like, oh my God, you know, how am I going to – this is going to be like herding cats to get this like these songs together.
Right.
All the tunings were weird, but he was challenged by it, and we met him, and I brought in my first 7-inch of the Mecht Mensch 7-inch that he did, the first record that he ever did, because it's a genius hardcore, Midwestern hardcore record. And I said, I want it to sound like this. And he's like, oh my God, what are you doing with that? You know, we only made like 100 copies of that. And I didn't even think it got out of Madison. It's like, how'd you get that? I was like, I have my ways.
Yeah.
And but I said, this is such a good record, you know, and we were playing it. And he was just like laughing to himself. He's like, well, you know, we did that like in one afternoon. I was like, fine. You know, it's just like, if we can do it one afternoon, I'm happy. I hate being in studios.
Yeah.
But he was great.
He
was really methodical. He made sure that we were always in tune to the tunings that we were tuned to.
Okay, yeah.
You know, that was really important to him. He was just like that, and he was diligent, like sitting in front of me and like one more micro turn. You know, oh, there it is. You know, and after
good ears.
Really good ears. And after each take, he would do that. And the thing is, it would that Goo was mixed by the same mix engineer who did Nevermind as well, and so we just basically copied that record.
But what was your relationship with those guys, with Nirvana?
Oh well, they were a Sub Pop band. We were friendly with Bruce Pavitt at Sub Pop early on, and you know Bruce would. I remember visiting us in New York, and he was talking about wanting to sort of start a label that put out records by different regions across the USA. And he had already done a fanzine and a cassette mixtape label and called Sub Pop.
Yeah.
We knew him because he kind of presented us in Seattle at some gig. And he was just on the scene as part of the university.
Yeah.
And then he went back home to Seattle and he decided like, well, I'll just sort of focus on Seattle before I do this other idea of like going across the USA and like, you know, having like this series of records.
Yeah.
To his and, you know, and it just became this thing where it's like Soundgarden, Mudhoney, you know, and all these bands that were just like getting getting some kind of cool attention. But yeah, it really wasn't until Bleach came out.
Yeah.
And then Nirvana got into a van and came out to play Maxwell's in Hoboken.
Sure.
And Suzanne Sasek, who was our, she was a woman who toured with us and first like did merch,
yeah.
You know, and then she did lights for us and she did illustration on the first Nirvana 7-inch label. And she said, oh, this is band Bruce has put out called Nirvana and they're playing at Maxwell's. We should go.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should. And well, yeah, support Bruce. Yeah, we'll go. I bet they're pretty good. If they're, she goes, they're not as good as Mudhoney, but I think they're pretty good.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's, I always remember her saying that.
Yeah.
They're not as good. She loved Mudhoney. And,
Mudhoney or Stooges band.
Yeah. So the Mudhoney had put out Touch Me, I'm Sick.
Great.
And I remember that record. It was brown vinyl 7-inch, and Suzanne had put like 80 copies in the front of the Pure Platters record store window in Hoboken.
I love Mudhoney.
Yeah. And so we went thinking like, oh, we're going to see some band that maybe is not as good as Mudhoney.
Right.
And they were opening up for Tad.
Oh, yeah.
Another sub pop band.
Sure.
And they were great.
I mean,
you know, they smashed all their equipment at the end, and I was just like talking to them afterwards like, do you have another gig? They're like, oh, yeah, we have to play the Pyramid Club tomorrow in New York City.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you might want to get some new guitars. I mean, you guys just smashed all your shit up. I couldn't figure it out because they didn't have any money. Nobody had any money. It's just like, so you don't want to break your equipment on tour, but they were just like caution to the wind, you know, like they had.
Did you see yourself in them?
There was something they were doing. They were really primal. There was something going on with that sense of energy, and there was something going on. There was one song, I think it's Drain.
Yeah.
Drain You or whatever, where Kurt is moving up on the neck with the guitar, like in these, and I think I write about this in the book, where he's going from like, he's going from fret to fret, like, and I was just like, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that sequence because it's really simple, but it's really effective. And in some ways, it's what I really loved about even more sort of sophisticated art rock, be it Television or Glenn Bronk or whatever.
Sure.
It's like these kind of moves that kind of have this effect. And he was doing it in a way that was in this kind of this punk sound that was like late 80s kind of punk sound. So it was like there was all this other stuff going on. The fact that they had – their music was so direct and it wasn't flowery at all.
Yeah.
And there was something about that I really liked because – it still wasn't just like it wasn't just like garage rock or something like that.
Sure,
but it had elements of it.
Yeah,
and I was really attracted to it.
Yeah,
and they looked fantastic. You know, the fact that Chris was as tall as I was.
Yeah.
And he didn't care.
Yeah,
and he was just like and like I always was very kind of self, you know, a bit self conscious.
Oh yeah, he's just
on
lurching around.
I still am self conscious on stage. If I go out and the stage is too small or whatever, I feel like I'm going to fall over. You know, it's like I have to wear the right shoes. Otherwise, I'm just kind of – I feel really dorky and gawky. But he was just like, you know, just flailing around. And Kurt wasn't so tall, you know. So he was like banging to Kurt, who's like just up to his like chest.
Yeah.
And Kurt would just like turn around and just like viciously push him back. Like, get the fuck out of my way.
Yeah,
stop bumping into me. Like, they were like these kids, these buddies in the backyard.
Yeah.
It was really great. It was really cool, and I didn't think anything of it. Where it's like, oh, this is going to be, you know, God's gift to like rock and roll or anything. But I did like it.
But so you can, as you move through like the 80s, you're a known quantity now, and you know you're a big band
in the 80s,
yeah.
In the late 80s. Well, yeah. we could sort of do well.
I mean,
we weren't like blowing out like big theaters or anything. I mean, like a band like the Pixies was way better, bigger than us. I mean, they would go out, and they were a band that started around the same time as us.
But you like them?
Yeah, I like the Pixies, but I think they were way more accessible as a band across the board, you know. And
but you guys,
there was a bit of a college rock kind of aesthetic.
Yeah,
and a lot of that college rock thing was about there was a certain kind of. Smart accessibility in a way. I think we were always a little possibly too challenging for like the casual
arty,
listener.
A little arty?
I guess arty farty, you could say that.
But you didn't ever like have a discussion with Lee or Kim and go like, we got to make some hooks.
Well, let's straighten out the edges a little bit. Never. In fact, if anything, it was like maybe our next album should be done with like chainsaws and pianos. Like, let's really fuck with
How
people.
Did you delegate who did what song? Was it, did Kim do writing? You did writing and
The songwriting was, we'd go through phases. I always thought the most successful songwriting is when we would just get together and start playing in the now. And things would happen, and we'd be like, what was that? Like, just do that again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with the recording technology, it would be even a cassette deck.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, go back to that point. And it's like, oh, let's work off that riff or whatever.
Oh, great.
And so that to me was, I liked. I would tend to sort of sit at home and come up with riff ideas that were sort of skeletal song ideas and bring them in. And show the band, and both Lee and Kim would create their own parts. I would never dictate like, okay, you have to play that, you have to play that.
Right.
That wouldn't happen so much. But so it would turn whatever I brought in into something a group oriented more.
Right.
So, and as far as lyrics, it was always like we would always primarily do all of the music instrumentally, and as we would get set to record, it's like, well, we gotta sing and do lyrics. That was usually the case. And it's like, and we would choose a lot of the times in the studio as we were laying down the tracks, like, I'll sing this one, you sing that one.
Yeah.
You know, we would sort of, hand them out a little bit. And at first it was basically just me and Kim. And then Lee started bringing in more fully formed songs pretty early on.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like it didn't take that long. But so there would always be sort of like, you know, the one Lee song on the record.
Yeah.
The
rest
were sung, traded off by Kim and I. And then he would become, there would be two Lee songs. And it was like that.
So, like, in closing, did you text your wife?
I turned my phone off so it wouldn't like.
I was just probably sitting out there in the car wondering.
I turned it off because I have a meds alarm. It goes off. I didn't want to go.
Oh, how's your health? All right.
I'm okay. I had some weird like heart arrhythmia situation that was getting more pronounced in the last couple of years.
They fix it?
They did. They did a thing called cardioversion.
Yeah.
You know, it was like zapping.
Yeah.
So it wasn't invasive and it worked. You know, like it either works or it doesn't, but it worked.
And, that's good.
So I was able to sort of get on an airplane and at least go see my daughter. And
well, where are you living?
I'm living in London.
That's good.
Evan and I have been living there 11 years, 12 years ago.
You like it?
Do I like London?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no guns.
Yeah, I know.
Number one. And, you know, it's its own. It's its own world of it has it's good and bad. I mean, it's like anywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
deep history.
I always quote like that. There's that Nick Cave movie where he's asking like, why do you live in Brighton? You know, which is south of London. He's like, you got to drop the anchor somewhere. And I was just like, that's it. I mean, and it's a lot of it's sort of just like. Where you live and how you situate your life is like there's a lot of happenstance there, and a lot of it's just like you have to sort of trust the fates on that one.
Yeah.
It's like you know where you live and what those decisions are, and then especially like if you're kind of in a relationship, that kind of like you know that kind of joint decision making, and it's just like it's really at this point in my life I find it just to be interesting.
Sure.
Like, so yeah, I live in London. We live like in like the burbs outside of London in a way. And then we spend a lot of time in South Miami because again, I have
got that place.
Some roots there. You know?
Yeah. You kept the house?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah. So we kind of hang there quite a bit. That's where I wrote the book. And it kind of is like,
you know, Cat Power, she was down there.
I know Sean. Yeah, she lives down there. I think she's playing here tomorrow night or something, or Wednesday night. I think she's playing somewhere, like at what's that hotel?
The
Ace. Yeah, I think it's like the theater in the Ace. Yeah. I think that's where she's playing.
Big place.
I think she's doing her Dylan thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Which I saw that in London.
Oh, okay.
It's definitely worth seeing.
When you look at bands like over the last couple of decades, who do you see as the direct legacy of you? Of
Sonic my God.
Like Pavement? Would you say Pavement?
Pavement was interesting because they definitely were young guys who were at the clubs when we were going out in our vans and playing.
Yeah.
So like when Swans and Sonic Youth would go out and like, you know, go up and down the East Coast or go out to the Midwest and back, people like Steve Malkmus, you know, or David Berman, you know, from Silver Jews.
Yeah.
These guys would be in the audience. They were they were a bit younger, and they were in, they were either in college or they or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were at the gig. So a lot there is that kind of contingent of people who were like really like into what was going on with like Sonic Youth and Husker Du and Butthole Surfers and the Meat Puppets. And that was our coterie. That was like going all through the 80s. That was the scene. And so there was like the dyed-in-the-wool kind of hardcore scene, which was really sort of dominant in some ways in like the underground music profile of USA. So you had your Minor Threat, everything coming out of Black Flag and Dead Kennedys.
Yeah.
All across the USA, that was like a very busy bee of a scene, you know, like 10 bands every night, you know, kind of thing. And then you had bands like Butthole Surfers, Meat Puppets, Sonic Youth, Swans, that were somewhat associated to that, but a little older and a little more outsider.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
We were kind of, but at the same time, kind of accepted by some of those bands. Certainly later when a lot of those bands grew up.
Yeah.
And they started kind of acknowledging us, like, oh, wait a second, you know, because they're burnt on the same old, like.
Meat Puppets are hard to classify. I love them.
Oh, extremely hard to classify. You can't. Yeah. They're just the Meat Puppets, you know. And so.
Same with Butthole Surfers.
Oh, my God. I mean, Butthole Surfers live, like in like 87, 88.
Yeah.
When they would come out with like the two screens showing whatever movies they were showing. The nude dancer, just that band, everybody tripping on LSD.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like, what is going on? And they would play these like long, like blown out sort of Texas garage rock kind of bass tunes with like crazy lyrics. Gibby, just like huge. He's as tall as I am,
you know,
but he's broader and bigger, and he's just like a pro wrestler almost. Just laughing and having the best time. You know, they were having the best time. Like all these lights going off, just wanting to create this spectacle. And they did. And there was like, it's really a little hard to like even explain like how amazing the Butthole Surfers were when they would come to town.
Yeah.
Because everybody who was into that scene would be at that gig.
Yeah.
And they would just be like, is this legal? I mean, this is I remember them starting fires on stage. That's over with. You can't do that anymore. But
yeah, well, it was great talking to you, man.
Yeah, no, I you know where to find me, man. If you ever want to, like, you know, talk more, I'm around.
Yeah, in London,
in London, in Miami. I'm in New York and Connecticut. I'm kind of New England. I'm kind of a bit of an Eastern Seaboard guy. Do you ever do London? I mean, do you ever come?
Yeah, home? I do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know? Stuart Lee.
Yep,
he's a good mate of mine.
He's great. I interviewed him years ago when I was in London. I love him. He's great.
Yes,
real smart guy.
We were neighbors for many years in London. Then we moved, but he just did the Sonic Life interview with me in London for the event there. And
yeah, he's great.
He's a good dude.
He's a one of a kind dude.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, smart guy.
I can't. His thing where he does his kind of repetition pieces.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it. So I go to see him once in a while, like, you know, at least once or twice a year.
Oh, that's good.
Because he does like he always has a residency at this one theater.
Oh, that's cool. Say hi to him for me.
I will. Yeah, for
all right.
Sure.
All right, cool.
All right, cool, man. Thank you.
There you go. Pretty fun. Pretty exciting. Sonic Life, a memoir, is available now wherever books are sold. Hang out for a minute, people. Okay, look, on Thursday, Todd Glass is back on the show. He's been on a few times, but his most notable episode was back in 2012.
I think we should be clear that you are coming out
here. Yes,
okay.
And here's the I wrote down nothing on this piece of paper except one thing, and then I thought, after this, just let it take its course.
Well, I mean, this is, I can't imagine what it must be like, because I've known you for probably 20 years, mm-hmm. 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
You are a beloved comic. And in the community, and everybody knows you. But I got to be honest, I never even thought about that.
Well, here's the reason. And once I get this out of the way, and then I'll have an honest, you know, like I'll go back and forth.
You got things you want me to say.
There's a little agenda.
Okay.
It's literally 2 minutes. You know.
Okay. No, we have a time.
You want your peers to sort of respect you. In other words, in my head, and it's just the way I think. They go, yeah, Todd did it on the Mark Maron show. And
yeah.
I know there's a shitload of people. As a comic, I don't like to be delusional. So if anybody went, oh, Ty went on the Mark Maron show to say he was, you know, we knew it. I know that there are people that were pretty fucking positive I was. They've been my friends for 20 years. I'm not with women. I'm not.
Right.
And then there were other people, maybe not as sure. Some people don't give a shit. I get it.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm saying it in some way like, I got something. I did not deliver it. If somebody out there tomorrow, I don't know why it bothers me, went, Todd said on the Mark Maron show, like we didn't know. Yeah, I fucking know that. I know that. But I've not been honest about it. So even if you know,
yeah,
I can't reference it.
Right.
I can't say it. I can't, you know, on stage maybe reference it. It's not going to become my act.
Right.
Now I'm just saying what a lot of people already knew, now I'm being honest about.
That's episode 245 with Todd Glass, and you can hear that episode ad-free with a full Maron subscription. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And just a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. And here's some prime Maron simple riffage with heart from the vault.
Monkey, La Fonda, cat angels everywhere.